This is a Pinball News production.
Thanks, guys. Y'all hear me all right in the back? Good. Okay, so as the title says, we're going to talk about the P-Rock, the P-Cubed, and the future of pinball. My name is Jerry Stellenberg. We founded a company about 6 months ago called Multimorphic, Inc. And we did that because we started out as pinballcontrollers.com, and we built this P-Rock board, and we built some other driver boards and some other boards. But pinballcontrollers.com implies you're building pinball controllers. And we wanted to branch out and actually build a real machine. So we switched company names, we switched our focus, and we'll talk a lot more about that. But really, the goal of the talk is to discuss the future of pinball. And I put a lot of time into this slide. The future of pinball, I mean, no one can really tell you what it's going to be. But what we can say is there's a lot of activity going on right now. And hopefully all this translates into good things, into positive things for the future of pinball. Now there are 4, 5, 6 new companies that have come up in the last 6 months, last year. Jersey Jack started, 2 years ago? And since then, there's companies all over the world that say they're going to produce pinball machines. And we feel pretty good about that because 2 years ago, as David said, we were here talking about the P-Rock board. We developed a board set that people could use to design their own machines. We feel like we enabled some of this expansion in the market. The thing is, if all of us go out and develop machines that are similar to existing machines, right, that have your standard play field, your display in the back box, your traditional features, you know, flippers, slingshots, pop bumpers, ramps, loops, playfield art, side art, all the things you guys think of as pinball machines. If we all go build the same machines just with different themes, is there a market that's big enough to support us all? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that any of us know the answer to that yet. We're going to figure it out. But our theory at Multimorphic, my goal is to help broaden the market. We need to bring more people into the market. We need to interest more people, get more people excited about pinball. And if we do that, maybe there is room for all of these companies to build new machines, to sell. I mean, people are asking anywhere from $5,000 to, I think, some of Papa Duke's machines were $17,000 for a machine. So we're asking a lot of money for these machines, and the market has to grow to support all of us trying to do this. Otherwise, we're all going to come out with a machine, and we're all going to lose money on it, and we're all going to disappear next year. And then it's just going to be Stern and maybe Jersey Jack again. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it could be better. So what we're doing specifically that other people I don't think are doing is we're creating choices. We're creating options for the players, for the buyers, for the operators. And we're going to talk more about all these things, but we're trying to develop a product and a product set that you can go buy or you can see other people buy and implement that allows choices. And we'll talk about those specific things. So 2 years ago, I was here talking about this board. This is the P-Rock board. This is a board that gives machine owners a way to put new rule sets on their machines. And they can really only do that if programmers get a hold of the board and start writing new code for these machines. So this board literally drops into a WPC machine or a Stern machine or a custom machine, and it interfaces to the driver system in those machines. So any programmer can then go and write new code for that machine. If you have a, pick a game, Medieval Madness, Attack from Mars, whatever, pull out the CPU board, stick in a P-Rock board, and you can write completely new code for that machine. And we have hundreds of customers doing that. All these customers right now are pretty much programmers. They get a hold of the board, and they start implementing new rules. And we support any OS, any programming language. We can use any feature that you can put in a computer, we can use. You can RFID, I used an example. You can implement some mechanism where you have a little wireless identification chip. You walk up to the machine recognizes who you are, it loads your statistics, and it loads the game rules that you had set up for yourself. These are all things that anybody could implement, any programmer could go implement because we have our board in the system and because it interfaces to a computer. So we're giving machine owners options to put new rules, new themes on their machines, and we're giving programmers options because we're not making them write code in assembly language. That where we're not making them use specific features. Really, the options are wide open. They can do whatever they want with them. So after we developed the PROC board, we developed this. This is a power driver board. It's a little bit smaller than the power driver board you're used to, hopefully. But it does the exact same thing. This specific board drives 16 devices, so you can connect it to 16 coils or flash lamps, motors, magnets, whatever you want. So if you're building a custom machine, or if you're a company starting up and you want to build a machine, you can take a PROC board, and then you can start connecting it to these driver boards. If your machine's going to have 16 devices, you need one board. Well, 16 devices isn't really a lot of devices. Most machines have a lot more than that. So the cool thing about these boards are you just chain them together. You can have two boards and drive 32 devices. If you have 48 devices, you just put three boards, and they all chain together. And because they're so small, you can put them anywhere you want in the machine. You can put them right under the playfield. You can attach them to the bottom side of the playfield, right next to the features that they're driving, which sounds a little weird probably right now because you're used to seeing boards in the back box. But if you go into the exhibit hall later, you check out our machine, which we'll talk about a little bit later, the P-cubed machine, there is no back box on the machine because we don't need one. We have all of our boards under the playfield exactly right next to the components that they're driving. If there's the flippers, for instance, that are in the front of the machine, the flippers and the slingshots, and I guess that's it, that at the front of the machine. And we have a driver board right on the bottom of the playfield at the front of the machine. And then we have more features down deeper, and then we have driver boards there too. But the point is, you can put them wherever you want, you can chain them together, you can add as many as you want, you can put in little boards like this. This little board sits on that same serial chain, and it'll drive 84 LEDs. So you no longer have this huge power driver board that's driving 32 coils and, I guess, an 8x8 lamp matrix or a 16x8 lamp matrix, I think, that the Stern boards support. You can chain these boards together, too, these LED boards. So you could have 84 LEDs on one part of the machine. You could put another board. You could have 84 more LEDs over there. You could actually create a DMD with little LEDs using all these LED boards. I don't know why you'd want to do it, but... One more board I wanted to show you is this board, which we just implemented. I know none of you really can see the details in any of these boards. I'm just trying to give you a feel for how small they are. This is a 2-inch by 3-inch board. This is our switch board. So traditionally, the switches are wired into the CPU board on a machine. And usually they're structured as an 8x8 matrix, and then you have 8, 16, maybe 32 direct inputs for flippers and other things. Well, this board is 16 inputs. It's got two 8-bit connectors, and they're all direct switches. So if your machine has 16 switches, you put one of those boards in. Same as before. If you need 32 switches, you put two of those boards in. And you can create a machine with 128 switches just by putting in more boards. So we kept the same methodology, the same thing I was talking about, choice. We're giving game owners choice by allowing them to put new rules on their machines. We're giving game designers choice by allowing them to structure a control system based on the features that are in their machine. So on our machine in there, we have a specific set of boards, but if we go build another machine with a different set of features, we don't have to use the exact same board configuration. We only need to use as many boards as we need. And the machine I've been talking about is called the P-cubed. So 4 years ago, I got bored of all the machines in my house. I was probably like most of you, and I had 10 machines in my house, and I got bored playing the same games over and over and over again, the same software every time I load up a machine. So I started thinking about what I could do to make an interesting game. I'm an electrical engineer. I play around with circuits and logic design and those kind of things, and I had some ideas for some game features I wanted to implement, and I wanted to build a machine, but I didn't have a way to do it. So I designed these boards. Once I designed the boards, I could build the machine. And this is a description of the high-level features of the machine. And again, it's the same theory. I wanted to give people choices. I wanted to make a machine that was dynamic, that was configurable, that we could do a lot of different things with. I didn't want a machine that was a single themed game. Where you go to the you go to your supplier and you go buy a machine, you again pick your game, Whitewater for instance. You go buy it, you put it in your house, and you turn it on, you hit start, and you play Whitewater's rules. And you play Whitewater's rules again and again and again and again, and you do that for 6 months, a year, and then what do? You probably sell the machine and get another one and put it in its place. I wanted to change that. I wanted to create a game where you could theoretically buy a machine once and play any number of different games on it. Different rule sets, different themes. You could have different artwork. You could have different, you could even have different shot layouts. Everything sounds pretty easy except the shot layout thing. How do you create a game where you can change up the shot layout? And I'll talk briefly about how we did that in a second. So I apologize. I was going to actually have the machine in here with an overhead camera rig, but the camera rig didn't work out. So the machine is in the exhibit hall. Feel free to come by later when the exhibit hall's open. Come by and play it. Talk to me about it. Whatever questions you have later that we don't get to or that don't get answered, feel free to come by and ask me about it. But this is a very dark picture of the machine. And the big feature that you're probably all noticing is there's a big LCD in the playfield. Can I actually quickly get a show of hands? How many people have not seen the machine yet? Okay, so about half of you. So the LCD in the playfield. Why is there an LCD in the playfield? Why are you turning pinball into a video game? I don't want to play a video game. I want to play pinball. Well, if you think about it, what is a playfield? A playfield's a piece of wood that you cut a few holes in, that you put some insert lamps in, that you put some components through, you mount some assemblies to the bottom of it, and they stick through to the top of it, and it's got some artwork on it. It's got some flashing lights, some features, and how do you do all that with a monitor? Well, I would argue that if we put a picture of a piece of wood on that playfield, it would play just like any other machine does. Right, the ball's going to roll over the flat surface just like it rolls over a piece of wood. The ball's going to roll over the insert lamps just like it would a piece of wood. So we could theoretically draw on that screen. We could draw insert lamps. We could whatever your theme is. If your theme again is Whitewater, we could draw water. We could draw rapids. We could draw a canoe or a raft or whatever it is. But the cool thing about it is then we can animate those things. We can move them. We can change them. We can. You hit a shot, and the whole background changes to a new picture or a new angle, or your raft is flowing through the rapids as you hit shots. We can animate all that. We can pretty much do whatever we want. It's a computer. It's a monitor. And then you get bored of that. You don't want to play Whitewater anymore. You want to play Medieval Madness. Okay, hit a button, and we draw a castle, and we draw trolls on the playfield, and we draw catapults, and we do all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, the point is, we have an LCD in the playfield. It's a flat surface. The ball rolls over it just like in any other pinball machine, but then we can change it up. We can change the theme. We can do whatever we want with it. But again, most people, when I talk to them about it, the first reaction, again, is there's an LCD in your machine. It's a video game. So how do we get over that perception? Which is what I believe. I think it's just a perception. So let's talk about physical features. I have four machines left in my house. Theater of Magic, Whitewater, Attack from Mars, Medieval Madness. Obviously, I've been choosing those as examples for a reason. I went through the other day, and I counted up all the physical features on those machines, and I compared it to the physical features we've put on the P-Cubed machine. And there's a list. The P-Cubes all the way on the right. The bright green ones are numbers where the P-Cubed has a lot more than the other machines, and the red one is the one feature that the other machines have more of, and that's pop bumpers. The P-Cubed doesn't have any pop bumpers on it. There is precedence for that. I think the Shadow doesn't have pop bumpers. I believe Judge Dredd doesn't have pop bumpers. There are a few other machines that don't have pop bumpers. But everything else, if you go through it, targets, for instance, there are a bunch of drop targets on all these machines. Drop targets are one of the staples of a pinball machine. Everybody wants targets. Stand-up targets, drop targets. We have 18 of them. We have four on each side. We have ones that go up and down, drop targets in the middle of the playfield, and it's hard for me to accept the feedback that it's a video game when we go and talk about these physical features. Again, if we drew on the playfield, if we drew a picture of whatever theme it is that the game is, and you interact with those features, you hit the ramps, you hit the loops, you hit the targets, it's just as physical. It's more, I would argue it's more physical because we have more features than any existing machine. And I guess there are some new machines coming. I think Wizard of Oz has a lot more targets than we do. They have a, how many targets do they have, Martin? They probably have 40 targets on that machine. But in general, the P-cubed is equivalent, if not, it might even have more than most traditional machines. Okay, so hopefully I can convince you it's still physical pinball. That's our goal. I'm a pinball player. I'm a guy who likes physical pinball. But again, I wanted to create a machine that had options, that had choices, that we could retheme. And like I said before, that we could change the shot layout. How do we change the shot layout? If you think about Pinball 2000, Pinball 2000 lets you pull out the entire playfield, put in a new playfield. That's technically changing the shot layout. It's a lot of work, it's an expensive playfield, but that's kind of the methodology we adopted. If I go back to the picture, you can't really see it, but everything beyond that line is a pluggable module. So the entire upper portion of the playfield, the ramps, the loops, there's some holes, there's some vertical up kickers, there are captive balls, there are four or five targets up there. Everything up there is part of a module. You can literally unscrew four screws, one in each corner, pull up the entire module, and we'll have new modules that you can stick into that. So if, for instance, you don't like the fact that we don't have pop bumpers, we'll come out with a playfield design that has pop bumpers. The design we have right now is a symmetrical design. It's got an outer loop, an inner loop, and a set of ramps. It's symmetrical. Some people don't like symmetrical designs. Some people don't like fast, flowy designs. We'll come out with new playfields that are asymmetrical or that, like I said, have pump bumpers or whatever. The point is, the upper playfield in the thing is modular, so we can completely change the shot layout based on theme, based on players' interests, or, you know what, we're actually planning on open platforming the interface to that module. So theoretically, anyone who has the interest and skills to do so, whether you're a company or an individual who just wants to create a custom version of this machine, you could create your own shot layout for it. And oh, by the way, we're making the entire software open platform too. So if you had one of these machines, you can write your own game application for it. You can design your own module for it. You could theoretically customize the entire machine. Okay, so that modular play field we're talking about is you pull out the play field, you stick in a new one, the machine recognizes it. That thing has an identification on it. The machine goes, okay, you just plugged in a new playfield. You just plugged in the Whitewater playfield. Let me load up the games that are compatible with Whitewater. So you power up the machine, you get a list of games you can choose from, and then you just select the games. So it auto-identifies. And like I said, we're going to allow people to develop their own modules for it. Cabinet. When you go in and see the machine, the first thing you're probably going to notice is, one, it doesn't have a back box, and two, it doesn't have any side art. Right now, it's just a... You can also see this on the picture, I believe. If you just... One more. It's dark, but you can see that the front of the cabinet right now is just a piece of... It's just a piece of plywood right now. That's actually red oak. Our goal is, again, to give people options. If you buy a pinball machine and you're going to stick it in your game room, do you want it to match the theme? Do you want it to match other games? Do you want it to match the decor of your room? Do you want it to match the furniture? If you have a pool table next to it, a furniture-style pool table, do you want it to match the pool table, or do you want it to be something totally different? So our goal, again, is to give people options. We want to have a website that's kind of like Dell or like Apple, where you go and you pick out the platform, you order the machine, and then you decide what the finish is. You decide if it's going to be an oak cabinet. You decide if it's going to be a cherry cabinet. You can decide if it's going to have screened art based on whatever theme it is that the game's set up to be. User customizable is kind of the focus of the talk, and it's also the focus of the company. We want to give people options. If you want a back box, we'll design a back box. We're going to design a back box. You can choose it on the website. Frankly, if I were putting the machine in my house, I wouldn't want a back box on it. And some of you are probably thinking that that's weird because pinball machines all have back boxes. And if you're putting a machine in a lineup with other machines, you want it to have a back box just so that it looks consistent. Well, again, when you go in there and see the machine, try to get a feel for how it feels inside of our booth. That machine is the exact same size as an existing machine. It's a standard body machine. Same length, same width, same height. But for some reason, without the back box, it doesn't feel that big. It looks like it's not a pinball machine sitting in a room taking up a whole wall of a room. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's just because it's a visual thing, it's a mental thing, because there's no back box. Anyway, if I were putting it in my house, I wouldn't want a back box, but I realize that other people do. They want back boxes. So we're going to design a back box. We're going to have screened art and or the option for a monitor up in the back box. And we'll tie hooks into that monitor so people can put slideshows, they can run animations, they can duplicate what's going on the LCD. We may even include a camera that you can put the output of that camera up on the LCD in the back box so other people can see what's going on. There are lots of options. We could set up an advertisement subsystem where if you're operating the machine somewhere, it can put up advertisements for your company or for other people who that pay you to put advertisements on your machine. There are tons of options. Coin door. Again, that cabinet picture did not have a coin door, but most people want a coin door in their machine, so the coin door will be an option. Leg styles. If you have an oak or a cherry cabinet that your pinball machine is sitting in, do you want metal brackets hanging down that the game stands on? I wouldn't. So we're going to have a bunch of different leg options. Leg options that match the cabinet style as well as the standard legs that y'all all are used to seeing. So again, go to the website, order the machine, pick out your artwork, pick out your back box, yes or no, pick out your coin door, yes or no, and then choose your leg style. Okay, software. So when we came out with the P-Rock board, we wanted to give people a way to easily program machines. But most pinball players, most pinball hobbyists aren't low-level programmers who can program in assembly language or low-level C or whatever the current language of choice is for the big-time pinball programmers. So we developed a framework. We developed a framework called PyProcGame. It's written in a very high-level language called Python. And it allows people that aren't professional programmers to program pinball machines. I don't know if you've been in Rob Anthony's room yet this week, but Eric Priepke has a Cactus Cannon in there that he completely customized the code for. All written in Python, all written on PyProcGame. You have to check out the game if you haven't seen it. The Cactus Cannon in Rob Anthony's room is fully custom code that Eric, he's actually, Eric, you want to raise your hand? He bought a P-Rock board about 3-4 months ago. Okay, 6 months ago. And in 6 months' time, he's completely rewritten Cactus Cannon. It's a fully playable game. I bet most of you will probably think it's original code because it looks and plays very much like the original, but there's a lot of new features, a lot of interesting modes, and a lot of other things that he's added to it to enhance the experience. I know a lot of people thought Cactus Cannon was unfinished, which is one of the reasons Eric picked it to develop on it. So he's done what he thought he wanted to do to make it a finished product. He's got people in other countries testing his code for him. We played it the other day, and like I said, it's commercial quality code. And the way he could develop that, the reason he could is because we developed this framework that allows people that aren't, like I said, low-level coders to write these custom machines or write these custom software apps. So the P-cubed machine we're talking about is based on PyProcGame. And as I said before, we're going to open platform the machine so anybody can write their own games for it. You can drop in your own your own graphics. You can write your own rules for it. You can tweak the rules that we have for it. And the reason that's doable, the reason you guys are going to be able to do that is because the platform, PyProc Game, is completely open source. It's completely free. There's a community that supports it. We have a forum where it's probably 30, 40 people visit the forum on a daily basis. Everyone asks questions about how to write code to do this or that, or how to set up a multi-ball, or how do you do a ball search using this code, or you know, how do you do any of this stuff. And we have a support community. It's community supported, so we don't have on staff people that are answering these questions. The community just gets together and writes code, shares code, answers each other's questions, and helps each other get going. So it's very supportive, it's very friendly, it allows people like Eric, like anyone else who buys a board to get involved very quickly, get up and running and develop a game. So that's the customer customization side. But we're not just shipping a machine that's this empty shell of a machine. We're developing a game that's a platform. We have the LCD in it. We have module shot layouts. We have all these things that we can customize. And our goal is to ship that machine at the end of next year with two complete game apps. We're right now pursuing a licensed theme, and we're also creating an original theme. By the end of next year, we'll have those completely developed. They'll be commercial quality machines or applications that you're used to seeing. And the reason I say we can go develop that in a year, I'm sure you've all been watching some of the other projects that are promised in a year and take 2 years, or we don't know how long they're going to take, but they seem to slip based on software development, based on board design, based on some of the low-level functions that are being implemented in the game just seem to take longer than people expect. So the reason I can confidently say we're going to have this machine shipping in a year is, one, we have the boards. We have machines that are using the boards. We have customers that are using the boards. We've been supporting the boards for 4 years now. We have the software framework. We have PyProc Game that people can develop on. There are probably, I don't know, I would guess there are 40 or 50 completely custom game apps being developed right now on PyProc Game. People using the PyProc board and developing their own rules for a game on PyProc Game. So the framework is very mature. The board set is very mature. Now it's just a matter of dropping in rules, dropping in game-specific features. And what's interesting to me is if you go and build a custom machine, if you piece together your playfield, you put in the board set, you install PyProc Game on your computer, literally the day you say run on PyProc Game, you can have a fully running attract mode. You can hit the start button, it'll kick out a ball. You can play through an empty skeleton game where it tracks the ball as it drains and it ends the player and it pulls the next player up. You pull out and plunge the next ball. It's a fully existing pinball framework. So I guess my point is that all of this work is already done. All we now have to do is go fill in our specific game's rule set. So pick our themes, create the rule sets, drop them in. Yes, of course, there's developing sound, video, and all those other things that are semi-important to a pinball experience, but we don't have to go and develop a framework, we don't have to go develop a board set, we don't have to develop a new machine because we have the working prototype, and I therefore think a year is reasonable. Here's the timeline in some more detail. So the machine in the exhibit hall is a prototype machine. It's our second prototype. We developed the first prototype. We had it at the Texas show back in March. This is our second prototype. The picture you saw in here was the picture of the new one. Timeline is prototype phase we're completing now. The machine's pretty well prototyped. We have all the features we want on it. We have all the customizable options, the modular playfield. Once you see it, you'll know what I'm talking about when I talk about floating slingshots and floating flippers and all these other things on it. Pretty much everything on that machine is custom. We did our own targets, our own standby targets, our own scoops, our own board set, our own flippers, our own slingshots, our own ramps, loops, you name it, our own captive balls. Everything on the machine is RGB lit. RGB is the big keyword in the pinball world right now. Everyone talks about how their game is RGB lit, What that means is every single lamp, every single feature on the machine can be any color we want it to be. Can be any one of 16 million colors. And that sounds like it's just a display. It's just a display thing. It's just to make the game pretty. But that's not really the case. We can set up modes where you have to hit a shot 6 different times. Every time you hit it, it'll change colors. And that color will represent how many more times do you have to hit it. So the colors can represent, they can represent mode status, they can represent goals, they can represent, yes, they can just represent artwork and be pretty. We can flash them in neat patterns and have you roll the ball around while they're flashing. But, I mean, obviously there's a lot more information you can put forth when you have 16 million colors to put on it. So the prototype phase is complete. And now we're in what I call R&D and fundraising mode. So we got seed funding about a year ago to go build our prototypes. We have a staff of 3 right now. We built the prototype by hand. We wrote the software by hand. We already had the board set. So we did all this with that seed funding. We're currently taking pre-orders for the machine. We'll talk about that a bit more in a second. And now we have to go do full-scale R&D, develop commercial quality software, take all of our hand-built mechanics and get them spec'd, get them engineered for reliability, for manufacturability, and we have to actually, you know, figure out how to build these machines. So we have relationships with contract manufacturers. We're from Austin, Texas, so it's a pretty big hotbed for contract manufacturers. We can go get all of our components, all of our parts, we can go get them built for us, and then we can give them off to another contract manufacturer to assemble them for us. We're not going to go build a factory. We're not going to go spend, what is it? I don't know how much Jack said he spent, but I've heard numbers thrown around like $2.5 million or $3 million to go build a factory to build pinball machines. And that's just not an expense that we feel is worthwhile spending. We can pay a little bit more money per machine, but go get someone else to build them all for us. We can get all the wiring harnesses built for us. Oh, by the way, wiring harnesses. Most of you were probably at the Stern Tour and you saw those big pegboards where they were doing the wiring harnesses, the really complicated wiring harnesses that are expensive to build. They're a manual process to build. You saw the people stringing them up. Then you got to test each and individual connection on that wiring harness. And if one dies, if one breaks halfway through the line, then you got to go rebuild a whole new wiring harness. Because we have these boards that we chain together serially that you can put next to the components, your wiring is literally point to point. If you want to drive your coils, you connect an 8-wire cable from that board to your coils. And that's it. It's not a part of a big tree of other wires going over. So the point is, wiring harnesses are very simple. You go tell someone to go build you a 2-foot length of an 8-conductor wire, put Molex headers on both ends of it. And that's something you can easily spec, something you can easily get done by a contract manufacturer. You can get a box, you can order out, get a box of 1,000 of them, give them to your assembly team, and they just pull them out of the box and stick them in the machine. So the point is, the process, it can be a lot simpler. Because of the way the boards are set up, it can be a lot simpler. Okay, so fundraising. We're doing the mechanical engineering. We're taking our hand-built features, our slingshots, our flippers. And for those of you wondering what they are, because we have an LCD monitor in the playfield, we can't drill a hole up through the playfield and mount traditional-style flippers, traditional-style slingshots. So we invented these new styles of slingshots and flippers that we call floating flippers, floating slingshots. They physically hang above the surface of the playfield. They hang from a suspended piece of plastic. It's a piece of Lexan, very durable plastic, and the flippers suspend from that so they can float above the surface of the playfield and not interact with the wood itself or the monitor itself. So obviously this is a new style of flipper design. We have to go make sure it's durable, that it's reliable, that we can get it manufactured, that we can get it built and make sure it's going to last 10, 20 years in an operator environment, which can be challenging. So we have to go get that engineered. We have to go get real software and graphics built. Since we have an LCD in the playfield, graphics are a very big part of the game, right? We can change up the artwork. We can change up the way the game looks and feels, like I said, but we have to go develop that stuff. which can be expensive. You can go develop 3D artwork. You can go develop, I don't know, pick your favorite video game, Call of Duty, or some new 3D intensive video game, and it costs millions and millions of dollars to go develop that software. But then you go look at other games like Wii Sports, Nintendo Wii Sports, a very simple game that's very fun that isn't that graphically intensive. So there's ways to develop these games that aren't necessarily as expensive to develop, but that can still be fun, that can still be visually interesting. And so that's kind of our goal, and that's what we're going to start with. Games that are graphically fairly simple, but that show you how a pinball game can be physical and fun without spending a $3, $4, $5 million on software development. So along with the same phase, we are pre-production planning. We have to figure out how to build these machines. Like I said, we're working through our relationships with contract manufacturers. We're figuring out how to do all that, and we've opened pre-orders. So again, we're currently going through a fundraising process. We're taking pre-orders at the same time. Those pre-orders are going into an escrow account. We're not spending anybody's money on anything until we're completely funded for the whole development cycle of the machine. If something goes wrong and we aren't able to raise money, then everybody's money will be completely refunded. There's no risk in pre-ordering as far as that goes. So the goal is to have a machine shipping and in production by the late next year. And like I said before, we're going to have two complete game apps. We're going to have a lot of mini games. And what is a mini game? A mini game, I don't know if you're familiar with... Well, actually, if you just think about a mode in a typical game, you shoot into a start mode hole, and some little mini mode starts up. Pick your favorite game. Theater of Magic has modes, has eight modes. One of them is shoot the ball into the trunk over and over and over. Hat Magic, I think it's called. Shoot it into the same hole over and over and over again as many times as you can in 30 seconds or whatever it is. So we have similar mini games. We're calling them mini games because they're not necessarily tied to a theme. We can go create a game. We have a game on the machine now called Barnyard where animals run across the screen and you shoot them with the ball and they spin around. It's a little, simple, silly game, but kids love it. We took the machine to a show in Texas. Kids started playing Barnyard, and we literally had to kick them off after half an hour. We had a line of 10 people behind them waiting to play the game, but the kids didn't want to get off the machine. So, mini games. We're going to have a bunch of mini games. And then, as we move forward, every year we're going to come out with 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 new game applications, new themes, new licensed themes, new unlicensed themes, original themes. These are things that our company, Multimorphic, is going to develop. At the same time, hopefully third parties, developers in the community, in the hobby, are developing their own things for it. But we're going to have 2, 3, like I said, 4 games per year, and every year we're going to come out with at least one new upper playfield, new shot layout. Like I said, we may do an asymmetrical one next with pop bumpers or things that are that people are more familiar with, things that they're more common on pinball machines. And we'll have these licensed themes that we're going to have to tie in artwork. We're going to have to create toys, shots that are specific to the theme to tie it all together. So that, like I said, probably two a year moving forward after we hit production. The price, it seems high. $10,000 for a machine. It's a little bit higher than Wizard of Oz. It's a little bit higher than the current Stern machines. It's a little bit lower than, I think, what John Papaduke is asking for his machines. Some of the other boutique guys are probably a little bit lower. We're offering a different value proposition than everybody else. Like I said at the beginning, we're trying to create a new type of pinball market where the customers have options, where you can load up new themes, new shot layouts, and you can have different experiences on your machine. Should you go buy 10 or 20 or 80 machines and stuff them in your game room, your garage, your, heck, probably half of you have games in your kitchen. Why not just buy a few machines that you can customize, that you can change the way it plays? That's the value we're trying to sell. We're trying to create an environment where you can go buy one machine, just like a video game console. You go buy a Nintendo or go buy a PlayStation. You buy the console. Then you start buying machines for it. The console, at the end of the day, wasn't that expensive relative to all the games you have that you can play on it. So that's our business model. Create a machine, a platform. Every maybe 5 or 6 years, we'll update the platform. There will be some new technology that we can implement into the machine. Every 4 or 5 years, we'll do that. But in the meantime, we'll probably have, by the end of the 4 or 5 years, 20 or 25 different complete different games that you can play on that machine, a completely new playable experience. So that's the value proposition. We feel like $10,000 is justified in that sense. Of course, I mean, we have to charge that much money because we're engineering new components. We're doing new flippers. We're doing new slingshots. We're doing these new targets. We have new board sets. So, I mean, we couldn't sell the machine probably for the same price that a Stern is, because they're established. They have all their board sets well-tested. Their flipper assemblies are well-tested, are well-developed. They're standard components. So it's a little bit more expensive up front for us to do this. But like I said, long-term, we believe the value is there. We hope you guys see it too. Once you play the machine, you'll please give me your feedback. Let me know what you think about it. Let me know if you think what you think we should do for shot layouts, what you think we should do for artwork, whether or not you would want a back box. Tell me all these things. At first, I wanted to sell a machine without a back box. And everyone said, no, you can't sell a machine without a back box. You have to have a back box. Steve Ritchie, I think, was the first one. He came by the show at Texas. He said, that machine is really cool. Actually, you've done some things that we wanted to do with Pinball 2000, or that we were hoping would happen with Pinball 2000 that didn't happen. We believe Pinball 2000 detracted from the pinball experience, whereas your machine is adding to the physical playing experience. But it has to have a back box. It's not a pinball machine without a back box. And I asked him why he said that. Why does a pinball machine have to have a back box? His answer actually surprised me. I thought he'd say because that's the way they look. If you're going to put your machine in a lineup, it has to have a back box to be consistent with everybody else. He said people want their boards, their circuit boards, at eye level so that operators, when they're fixing boards, they're in the arcade or whatever, they're fixing a problem. He said they want their boards at eye level. He said Atari tried, I'm not familiar with the history, he said Atari tried a machine without a back box, and I believe they had their boards at the bottom of the cabinet or somewhere in the cabinet. And he said that didn't work for a couple of reasons. One, you have metal dust and things falling down into your boards, but the boards aren't at eye level, so people didn't enjoy maintaining them. They didn't enjoy working on them. It's an interesting discussion because in our game, because like I said, we have all these boards that are under the play field right next to the components that they're driving, you lift up the play field and all your boards are at eye level. So our boards are not at the bottom of the cabinet. They're not on the side of the cabinet. They're not at the bottom or the top of the play field. They're right next to the features that you're fixing. So if you're trying to debug a flipper problem, you go to the driver board right next to it. The LED's out, the fuse is probably blown, or you look at the transistors, maybe one of the transistors blew for whatever reason, you had a short somewhere. The boards are right next to the features they're driving. So I don't know. So Steve Ritchie's opinion about why we needed a back box doesn't fit for this, but again, the feedback we got from everyone else was it has to have a back box too, because that's what pinball machines look like. Pinball machines aren't pinball machines without a back box. So again, we're going to offer a back box as an option. Go to the website, order the machine, choose yes or no, I want a back box. We'll probably have different Translite artworks you can select from. I want a back box with this picture, this picture. I didn't like the shadow picture. I want the alternate shadow Translite, so let me pick that one. Again, options. We're all about options. If you want to order it now, go play the machine. Go talk to us in there. Play the machine. If you want to order it now, we're dropping $1,000 off the price right now. Again, we're not going to ship the machine for a year, so it's a little weird to go pay for a machine now and not get it until a year. But, pardon?
There is a precedent for that.
There is a precedent for that. There's probably a few precedents for that. Yeah. But the goal for me right now is to raise money. So if I can go to investors and say I have 100 people that are interested enough that they put down full payment, that they want the machine, they've committed to the machine, I go to investors and say, look, we have the prototype, it's a playable prototype, we have customers that are interested, we've pretty well proven the interest in the machine. We have the numbers. We have a table showing where we're going to make money, how much it's going to cost to do this, where we're at break even, and where we start making a profit. We can go to investors and say, listen, it's a real business. We can go do this. We can justify it. If I went to investors now and said, we have a couple people interested. They've been talking about it. People say they're going to buy it. People talk about it like it's kind of neat, and they want to buy it. Investors when you're in the pinball industry, look at you like you're crazy. Like, really? You're going to go buy a pinball machine? You're going to go build a pinball machine company? There's, LeStern's been alive for a while. Actually, we all owe Gary Stern a little bit of a debt of gratitude because he's kept pinball alive for the last 10, 15 years while all the other companies were dropping out. But investors just aren't going to buy that story. They need to see that you have interest, that you have people really committed to buying the machine. And so that's what we're doing. We're taking the pre-orders now, we're still raising money, and then we're going to go build the machines next year. And so again, I apologize. The presentation isn't exactly what I wanted it to be. I wanted the machine here. We were hoping to have a camera rig set up where I could have the machine on the floor. I could walk you through some of the modes, some of the displays, some of the things, but the camera rig didn't work out. So please do come into the exhibit hall and check out the machine, talk to me about it, ask me your questions. Well, actually, let's talk about questions now. Anybody? Yes, please. The question is, what is actually modular? What are we plugging in the upper play field? What part of the shot layout are we changing? The answer is, it's about a 21-inch by 21-inch square section. There's a row of scoops, of walls and scoops that go up and down that change. Right beyond that is a piece of wood with ramps and loops and targets mounted to it. It's the full width of the playfield, which is about 21 inches wide. The depth of it is about the same. It's about a square. So that whole module, from that position behind the scoops to the... this picture really isn't probably the right picture to show you.
Okay, well, just saying that it's one clarifies a lot. So it's got the whole personality.
Yes, everything beyond those... You can see the wall targets that are raised up. Beyond that is a single module. Pick up the whole thing. Like I said before, there might be six screws, one in each main corner of it. Unscrew it, pull it out, drop a new one in, you're good to go. Yes?
How much do you anticipate?
Don't know yet. It's obviously going to depend on the specific module. If we do a theme where there's lots of interesting toys and weird shot mechanics and things, my guess is right around probably between $600 and $1,200, depending on the complexity of the module. We're hoping to hit about an $800, $900 price point. Yes? Right. So we'd like to have some for free. We'd like to have some for purchase. We're going to set up an app store. Probably they'll be around, again, I'm guessing, because I don't know exactly the dev time it's going to cost for each one. Some themes will require a lot more artwork and sound work and other things, but probably around the $100, $200, $300 range for the applications. So you buy the machine for $9,000, $10,000, and then you can essentially buy a completely new game on top of that for a playfield plus an app, which if we hit the $900 and $300 price point, for instance, it's $1,200 for a completely new game. So the value kind of works itself out pretty quickly. Assuming the games are interesting, assuming the games are fun, assuming we can create an experience that rivals a fully separate machine experience, then the value should work itself out pretty quickly. There was a question. Yes, please.
On the larger circuit boards.
Yes.
A couple of things. As you start daisy chaining, what is the response on that multiple and a lot of other stuff going on at the same time? These things, but you've got a number of chains in a row.
The question is, once you start chaining all these boards that you're talking about together, does it, I'm gonna summarize a little bit, does it change the way, the timing of how things respond? If you're trying to drive coils or whatever, and the coils are at the end of a long chain of driver boards, does it take a while for that signal to get to the coils to activate? Or the switches, if you're trying to scan switches, does it take a while for that data to come back? The answer is, it doesn't matter. The length of the chain doesn't matter. The chain determines how clean the signals that are traveling down the chain look. If we chain 20 boards together, the time it takes to get data back from the 20th chain will be almost exactly the same times it takes data to get back from the first board in the chain. Everything's running. This chain specifically runs it at 8 megahertz, which probably doesn't mean a whole lot to you right now. But a lot of you have probably heard about the CAN interface. It's a bus that they use in automobiles. It's I think it's the bus that I've heard Stern is using on their new board sets. The CAN bus is an industrial automation bus that runs on two wires, so serially chained devices, and your host can talk to all the boards on that chain. But again, the time it takes to get from the front to the back is based on the clock frequency that's going down the chain, which is in the CAN's case, it's 1 megahertz. In our case, we didn't use CAN. We used what's called RS-45, a serial interface that's based on, actually CAN's based on it. CAN runs on top of RS-45, and then they added a lot of software levels. I mean, I know I'm getting technical, probably too technical for the seminar, but CAN runs on top of this two-wire serial bus called RS-45. We implemented RS-45 and they did our own protocol on top of that, a very simple, we don't need all the redundancy, all the error checking, all the interesting features that are in a CAN bus, because we don't have to support a bunch of different manufacturers building devices that are going to sit on our chain. So we created a very simple bus. The only thing that you do when you chain a lot more boards together is the last board in the chain has to be what's called terminated, which improves the signal as it goes down the chain. So whichever, we have a dip switch on the board, so whichever board is the last one in the chain, you set the dip switch on it, and the signal integrity is good, and like I said, the timing doesn't matter. The timing to talk to each board is sub-microsecond timing. Microsecond. The switch matrix is scanned in milliseconds, which is 1,000 times slower than a microsecond. So we can talk to things thousands of times faster than we need to take care of all the... Is what I just described fast enough to run a pinball machine on? You can go play the machine and tell me if it is. But if we can talk to things in 10 microseconds, that's 100 times faster than it takes an existing pinball machine to scan the switch matrix, which happens in a millisecond. So we're on the order of 100 or 1,000 times faster than existing pinball machines. Question is, these are technical questions about setting up a board set and how, if you're building a custom machine, for example, how do you decide how big of a power supply, what kind of power supply you need to drive these boards? And actually, these boards are interesting because we don't take AC power, we take DC power. The transformers that are in your existing machines, your Stern, your WPC machines, they have these power supplies that are 6 volt or six different voltage transformers, maybe 7 or 8 voltages on these transformers. They're all AC, alternating current. You plug your AC line into them, it converts them into whatever they are, 5, 12, 20, 50, a bunch of different voltages. We take DC power, which is simpler for someone to go design into their system. They don't need a multi-voltage transformer. They can go to the store. You can actually go to eBay and you can go buy a 7-amp 50-volt supply for probably $30. Instead of paying what is $100, might even be $200 for a WPC transformer, if you can even find one. Stern transformers might even be $250. I don't know, from a Marco Specialties or something. But you can go to eBay. You go figure out. We have I think 40 coil circuits on the P cubed in there. Each coil, we don't have a formula for it. Each coil has a spec. It draws a certain amount of current, which tells you how much voltage you need to supply to that device. So you go add up all your coils. In the worst case, I'll have X number of coils on at the same time. Therefore, I need a power supply big enough. That determines how many volts you need. Your volts are determined by the type of coil you're using or the amount of power you want to drive it with. The what you need to figure out is how much current it's going to draw when you activate your coils. So you add up your current requirements for all these devices. Again, I apologize for the low-level stuff. It's a little more technical than probably most of you care about. But you go add up the current draw for all the devices that can be on at the same time. So you have 5 devices that all drive an amp, that all draw an amp, that'll all be on at the same time. You need a 5-amp supply. Or put in some overhead, you need a 7-amp supply or whatever. So no, there's no formula that I spec, because I don't know what your machine's going to be. You're going to go put a machine in with 10 coils and 20 motors and 3 magnets or whatever it is. I don't know how many you're going to drive at the same time. And it depends on what kind of magnets you use, what kind of coils you use, what kind of motors you use. So that's something that you, as the engineer on your machine, are going to have to figure out. But again, the fact that we're using DC instead of AC means you can just go to any old DC supply, pick one at the store, and stick it in your machine, and it should work. You don't have to get a customized multi-voltage transformer to stick in your machine. Yes? So I'm guessing everyone heard that. Let me restate it just for the sake of making sure everyone heard. He's suggesting that he doesn't like the PCBs mounted under the playfield. He thinks it'll be easier to work on if they're probably mounted to a side panel or very accessible from opening up a side panel. And you know, it's interesting because I've talked to a number of people about this over the last 6-7 months, and everyone has a different opinion. But what's interesting about these boards are you don't have to work on them in place. The driver board has 4 headers. If you have a problem with your coils or whatever, just pull the board out, throw it away, stick a new board in. You're not replacing a $350 board, you're replacing a $100 board. So you'll probably have some backup, stick a new one in, take your old board back to the shop and fix it. It's a slightly different methodology, yes. I agree debugging boards in circuit under the playfield is no fun, but frankly, I hate debugging boards in a back box, too. I'm bent over the machine. I'm reaching into a corner that I can barely reach trying to hook up a meter to something, and that's no fun either. So, yeah, there's a trade-off there. Yes, we could mount them lower. I disagree that it won't be much different about the wiring harnesses, but the wiring harnesses will be significantly longer to get to all these boards that are mounted on the side. You got to run them out and whatever. But, yeah, again, there are lots of different opinions. Yeah, it's a good question. How many are we planning on building? I should have put that on the slides. We're building a run of 250. We're pre-ordering for the 250 now. We're hoping that we have a waiting list at the end of that 250, and if so, if it's big enough, we'll go build another run of whatever size it needs to be after it. The first 250 we're calling special edition. We're doing some neat features that aren't going to be available in follow-on ones, like, for example, some of the MIDI modes we're designing. We're going to integrate customer assets. If you want to be in a pinball machine, you'll load up your images, your sound files, a picture of your house or your whatever it is you want to integrate in the machine, and we can integrate that into the mini modes. We'll do some other things for the pre-orders, but so 250. Can our contract manufacturers handle the customizable the options that we're proposing? And that's actually the great thing about contract manufacturers. We can go and order. You say we have orders for 250 machines. We want 10 with a back box, 25 without, and logistically they will handle all that. And it sounds like I'm passing the buck onto someone else who's then got to go manage it, and that's not the case. We will be working directly with their engineers. They have these, they call them engineers. That you go and train how to build your machine, and then they go and manage the actual laborers who are actually building everything and putting everything together. But they have instructions. You give them a list of instructions, you walk them through it, you show them how to build it, you show them all the parts, you pretty much build a few by hand with them to teach them how to do it. And then for each option, you have a different set of instructions. So all they have to do is pull the main chassis off the line once they have it done with the main playfield, the LCD, the flippers, and all that stuff. And then it goes into a different line for each option. If you need a back box, it goes into this line. If you need different side art, it goes into this line, and they just slap it on together. They'll have different stations for all these things. So no, the answer is it was slightly more complicated for them to manage it, but it's not an issue. No, and the numbers we're talking about, it really just turns into cost. How much does it cost us? How much do we have to pay for the ability for them to do this for us?
Okay.
Time sink. Now, we've been talking to contract manufacturers for a while now. Like I said, we're in Austin, and Austin's pretty big for contract manufacturers. Actually, a lot of them start out as circuit board manufacturers, and they branch out into equipment and start building them. But they have huge facilities with the most of you, again, probably went to the Stern tour. These guys have facilities that are equivalent, if not significantly larger, than the Stern facilities, and they've just got rows and rows and rows of machines, of people, of equipment, and they can put this stuff together. We're working through the details of that right now, and I don't foresee it being a problem. Anybody else? Questions? Yes, please. Yeah, it's a good question. I talked about building building graphics and making the machine look like an existing machine by putting artwork on there and by putting whatever graphics tie into the themes or whatever, but he's asking about scores and data that you would typically have maybe in the back box on a DMD or in the LCD in a back box on a new machine. How do we do that? And it's just artistic choice, right? The person developing the game software is going to put data in there with the score, with the player information. It'll be overlaid probably on top of or cycled through along with the graphics. Please do come into the exhibit hall and play the machine. We have a score. Right now I have the score set up, so it's in the top right corner, I believe the score is, and there's a player number. And below that, both below it in three dimensions and in two, so lower on the monitor, but also below the score, if you were looking from above, is integrated graphics into the artwork. We actually, one of the many modes we have right now is like an Asteroids game, where you have asteroids floating around the screen. And they float around under the score, over the score, around the score, around the text that shows up. We have instructions that pop up on the screen as, for example, you start the ball and there's a skill shot. A flying saucer flies across the screen. If you shoot that flying saucer with the ball, it lights mode. You'll see some text that says, mode lit, shoot center hole to hit the mode shot. It gives you instructions. It gives you the score. It gives you all that data. It's artistic choice how to integrate it into your display. But sure, that's where all the information will be, yes. Yes, there's a sheet of Lexan, very hard plastic, over top of the monitor. It's just like, I don't know what machines have. The Haunted House has an insert. Games like Creature from the Black Lagoon has that insert. And there's plastic. AC/DC has one, the new AC/DC. There's a piece of plastic underneath whatever feature that is in the center. It's plastic. Yeah, actually, ours, you just pull it right out. It sits in there. It sits in there flush. So, yeah, if for some reason it got too scratched up, you didn't like it anymore. The thing is about Lexan's very durable. Lexan, unlike acrylic, unlike just regular, some of the cheaper, softer plastics, it's very durable. So it's not going to break, it's not going to crack. It may over time get scratched. And yeah, you just pull it up, stick a new one in, you're good to go. That's a good question. Is it a standard monitor? What do you do if the monitor dies? In the prototype, it's a standard monitor. When we go and build the production machines, we can't use a standard monitor. They all have different lifetime specs. Actually, we talked to the suppliers for the monitors, and they're like, we can't guarantee it'll work. If you're running it at 24 hours a day or even 12 hours a day, we can't guarantee it'll work more than a year. So obviously, that's not going to fly for a commercial quality machine like a pinball machine. So yeah, we're going after a commercial quality display. It's either going to be a 27-inch or a 32-inch display, and it will be commercial quality. The ones that are designed to be laid on their side, the ones that are designed to be on 24 hours a day for years on end. I mean, worst case, he's asking about, is the monitor that we're using going to be easily replaceable if something happens to it? Are you going to pick a monitor that has specific mounting requirements that if it goes end of life in a year, then we can't replace the monitor and your machine's pretty much dead? The answer is, if we have to change out the monitor for whatever reason, the manufacturer stops making them, then we would supply you with additional mounting brackets to mount them. That's our responsibility to do that. So, yeah, we would take care of that. We would support it. Whatever it is our long-term maintenance contract is for the machine, we would take care of it for 5 or 10 years or whatever that is, yeah. Any other questions? No? Well, please do come by the exhibit hall. We had the machine in there for a few hours last night. We'll have it whenever the exhibit hall is open. We'll be in there. It's playable. Again, we're open to feedback. Come tell us what you think of it, what you would do differently with it, where you want to see us take it, why you want to buy it, why you don't want to buy it, why it's too expensive, why you think we could charge more for it, whatever it is. Whatever your opinions are, we want to hear them. So please come by and check it out. Thank you.